Quality proteins aren't just for special occasions. With Omaha Steaks, you get unbeatable flavor and value delivered right to your door. They have an unmatched selection of perfectly portioned proteins, including USDA certified tender, steaks, burgers, chicken, pork, seafood, and more. All flash frozen at their moment of peak quality. Then quickly delivered to your door in a dependable cooler. So a great dinner is just minutes away. From Taco Tuesday to a weekend feast. Omaha Steaks practically invented meat delivery, and they've been perfecting the art of premium proteins for over 100 years. With their 100% satisfaction guarantee, you can order with complete confidence. Taste the Omaha Steaks difference, a better, more convenient way to buy proteins. Start getting flavorful proteins delivered today. Visit omahasteaks.com and get $35 off with promo code AUDIO at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com, code AUDIO. Terms apply. See site for details.
Today, we're joined once again by author and researcher Larry Hancock as we review the series on the Soviet Union. Larry's known as someone who is steeped in the documents and is committed to only the most solid evidence. And he's not afraid to say it if he doesn't agree with what everybody else in the critical research community is saying about something. Larry is a board member of the Mary Farrell Foundation, a major online interactive history archive. He's written many books, including ones on the political assassinations of the 1960s, like Killing King, The Awful Grace of God, Someone Would Have Talked, and Tipping Point, The Conspiracy That Murdered President John Kennedy. His most recent book, The Oswald Puzzle, Reconsidering Lee Harvey Oswald, is out now, with a second edition on the way. In this episode, Larry is here to help us recap the five-part series on the Soviet Union as a potential culprit in the JFK assassination. Coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Larry, welcome back to Solving JFK, man.
It's great to be back. We've had some great conversations.
I know you will keep it real, and I know that what you're saying is based in the documents. So that is that's the truth. I think I left out some of your books in my intro. Are there some other ones you want to mention quickly that
I think some of the books that relate to some of the issues, questions we're talking about today, the geopolitics of the early 60s, basically covert warfare versus overt political activities comes into play a lot. So Surprise Attack would be one of the books, again, pretty large book, 400 some pages, that deal with what was going on from a military standpoint with geopolitics, a lot of Kennedy's decisions, Eisenhower's decisions on various things, the differences in their policies, and their interaction with the military community, which is something we're going to be talking about. Shadow Warfare looks at the covert side and kind of contrast what people were saying in public versus doing in private, especially about covert operations, regime change, that sort of thing, back-channel communications. You know, again, the dichotomy between American foreign policy as stated to the public by the State Department and the administration, and American foreign policy as to what was actually going on behind the scenes that wasn't in the press releases.
Right.
Now, those two books, plus if we get into like the Bay of Pigs, those sorts of things, a book, In Denial, is probably my premier work on actual covert, highly deniable operations such as the things that JFK was doing in 1963, and how they were different than what had been done before, and how chaotic the situation was, really, which understanding the chaos of Kennedy's administration circa 62-63 is really the key to a lot of this, because we oversimplify a lot. And the timeline, JFK was a very situational guy. He's very pragmatic. He was very, very experienced as a decision maker. So he was willing to change his positions as new data became available. So if you're not working off a very specific timeline of what was happening in what month even, and what was in play and what had been abandoned, it's easy to get lost. And I'm afraid we do that a lot by making very broad statements that just don't work.
Sure. Well, let's jump into it here. So, and just zooming out a little bit, right now I'm on this sort of journey, I guess, if you will, to try to look at all of the potential culprits, all the people who, you know, either there's evidence to support, hey, this person could have had some motive or some involvement, or there's a large group of people that thinks it, so we need to talk about it type situation. So we've worked through many of the main primary culprits, and all I have left is the Soviet Union, which we're going to talk about today. Then I have Cuba, Cuban exiles, a little organization called the Central Intelligence Agency, which is going to take a long time, and then the generals is sort of the last, is where I'm kind of going to end it. So we're looking today right now at the Soviet Union. And so the question is, why look at the Soviet Union? What's their angle? And it's obvious, but just to sort of state it, that's the key rival during the Cold War, you know, of the United States. And also with regards to Lee Harvey Oswald, there's the specific connection of him going over to the Soviet Union. And then, you know, there's his visit to Mexico City, which we'll touch on later. And there's the embassy correspondence, which we'll also talk about. So you look at those things, and it's easy to sort of just fly by night if you're not really steeped in the evidence and you just hear what I just said. It's easy to go, oh, well, yeah, I mean, it seems like the Soviets did it. That's kind of the real story, which is also what the Warren Commission was told. But so anyway, that's why we're looking at them. And, you know, going into office, JFK was sort of a hawk. I mean, he ran on the missile gap, this idea that we were behind in the amount of missiles that we had versus the Soviet Union, which ended up not being true. And then we got to remember that Bay of Pigs, you know, in April of 1961, just months after Kennedy came in, really alarmed Khrushchev and alarmed the Soviets. I mean, there were consequences for that. It wasn't like, you know, there was no downside. So then we also have one thing just to point out early on, because this was, you know, RFK started his relationship with Bolshakov, I believe in like the summer of 1961. It might've been in the spring, but at any rate, that ended up being a really big deal. And there was this back channel between Bolshakov, RFK, who would go straight to Khrushchev. And then also, there were other back channels used as well, Karlamov and Dobrynin. The point is, JFK didn't like going through official channels when it came to talking to the Soviets. We've got RFK telling Bolshakov, this Soviet GRU agent in 1961, that JFK's own military and CIA might, quote, put him away. How literally should we read that? And I guess what's your perspective on you know, the necessity of this back channel communication point?
One of the things that comes up into that is terminology and Russian usage versus American usage. For put him away in U.S. terms might be that the U.S. generals, who were quite openly speaking to the public, you know, they didn't pull their punches. They would say what they liked and didn't like in an administration, might oppose JFK's policies. However, in the Soviet experience, opposing the policies of a Soviet leader usually led to them being eliminated, either politically, not even gracefully politically, like, okay, you're gone, you're just you're taken out of action. So I think in one case we're talking about a warning to the Soviets that setting up a mission with, when you're talking with JFK, just remember that he has political constraints that your Soviet leaders don't have, because JFK is responsible to his public, which includes his military, and they're perfectly ready to support political opposition to him. That, so when you can even consider it as essentially, basically a positioning for negotiations, like don't push him too hard because he's not going to soften because he has political concerns. If you push him to the wall, he's just going to get harder.
Right.
They are going to push him into a harder position. Now, whether that's really true or not, it certainly makes it sense for RFK to be setting up this dialogue in terms of don't push the president too much. You'll put his back up against the wall, and you'll make him even harder to deal with. So I see it more of a at that point in time in particular, I see it more of a positioning for negotiations with Khrushchev, which they knew was going on and was going to go on. There were going to be summit meetings, there are going to be confrontations. So I don't think a literal interpretation of the wording is right. I think it's got to be put in context.
Let's turn to Vienna and Berlin, and just to continue looking at the context. So in Vienna, of course, Kennedy goes there, and it's in June of 1961, which is, again, the Bay of Pigs was just in April. So I don't know what was expected, but I guess one thing that jumped out to me as he's in Vienna, just from a strategic standpoint, after the Bay of Pigs, you've got Cuba, which is so close, but Berlin is surrounded. Really, from the Soviet side. So there was like a sort of a clear analog, I guess, on the thing that we cared about that was close to the Soviets. This crisis in 1961, the fall of 1961 at Checkpoint Charlie. This is all JFK's first year. He's got Berlin, he's got Bay of Pigs, then he's got the Vienna that doesn't go well. It's going to be a cold winter. Then we got Checkpoint Charlie and the general that he sent in there, Lucius Clay's secretly trying to, bulldoze the Berlin Wall without telling him about it. And then he ends up resolving Checkpoint Charlie. How? Through Bolshakov. Oh, and I remember what I was going to say before, on Bolshakov, and if you could comment on this. Even though there's back channel communications with Bolshakov, the reality was that everybody knew, in the intelligence agencies, et cetera, w was generally aware that these communications were ongoing. So the purpose of the communications must have just been that he trusted that his true message would get across, maybe more so than he wanted it to be secret, would you say?
Oh, I'd absolutely say that. And I would add one thing to your list. Laos, in his first 3, 4 months in the presidency, JFK learned quickly that he could not tell everything take everything the Joint Chiefs of Staff were telling him literally without questioning it, without challenging it. Within his very first few months in office, they were pushing him for a land incursion in Laos and to put troops into Laos and to essentially go up against the Chinese. And I find it interesting, as a side note, at one point in time, Kennedy turned to one of them and said, "Well, how are you going to move, thousands of troops into Laos?" "Well, we're going to move them by air." Kennedy goes, "Do they have airfields there?" And the chiefs look at each other, and one of them says, "Well, they have one." It's like, wait a minute. I need to be asking these guys a lot of questions rather than taking everything they say on face value. So that's part of the context I think you have to have. But you brought up a really important point. We tend to ignore Berlin when we talk about the JFK assassination and all of this. To Kennedy, Europe, quite frankly, was still more important than anything else. Just like to Eisenhower in making his decisions about the French in Indochina, he decided to go with the French because Europe was more important than Indochina. So he decided to go with a colonial regime. Bad decision, but Europe always retained this special importance. It has over the decades until now, apparently. But Europe was at the top of JFK's mind, and Berlin was as important or more important to JFK than Cuba or Vietnam. And you hear that and see that in some of his exchanges. It's kind of like, you know, we can't do this here because Berlin is the focus. We have to maintain our strength in Berlin. That's where we're facing down the Soviets. We're not really facing down the, you know, this is direct confrontation with the Soviet armies who outnumber us 20 to 1. If the Soviets are going to win anywhere, they're going to go through Berlin. And so that's a very important point that you bring up. And it was very important for him to appear tough in those negotiations. And he had a problem. Khrushchev felt that he was not strong in those negotiations. He came out of it, you know, Khrushchev was concerned about his relationship with Kennedy. You know, where's this guy? How far can I push him? How far can I not push him? Which set up, I'm afraid, the missile crisis. But just a quick answer to your point, Berlin was of much more importance to JFK and a lot of this than is generally discussed.
Yeah, and what I would say about Berlin, how I saw him talk about it with the generals, particularly around the Cuban Missile Crisis, is he was kind of on a different planet with the generals most of the time. And they were just talking about totally different things in regards to what they should do. But that was the area of common ground. Kennedy would go, "You understand, if you do this, they're going to take Berlin." And then all the generals would go, "Yes, they probably will take Berlin if we do that. It's a good point. Yes." So that was sort of like the only way to prevent them.
It also emphasized, you talked about him going in as a hawk. And the funny thing is the generals knew this. Sometimes they would kind of ignore it or walk around it. But in terms of Berlin, again, it's not generally known that on the table, Kennedy put a response plan on the table, very detailed response plan to a Soviet push west. It was under a code name Pony Blanket, coming from his kids, actually, in the White House, that went all the way up to tactical nukes. And he granted authority all the way up to tactical nukes to defend Berlin, to push them back. And you've got to, I don't know if anybody has ever listened to that recording of his phone call with the guy at Checkpoint Charlie, the tank commander. He's on the phone with the tank commander saying, "If those Russian tanks move, you move. We'll be there. Do not back down. And I'll stay on the phone." Like, okay, I am in charge. This is, if it goes, it goes up.
Wow. Kennedy was on the phone?
Yes.
Oh, that's amazing. Pony Blanket. I feel like I now have to start another cover band and call it Pony Blanket. Because it will literally cover you. Anyway, let's pivot to the Cuban Missile Crisis if we can. It's a nice little segue. So I'm going to cover it super high level and just kind of walk through. If you don't know anything about the Cuban Missile Crisis slash covered, you know, talk about the high points as it relates to JFK's decisions during it. All right, so. First of all, the Soviet logic for placing these missiles in Cuba was that they were worried about an invasion of Cuba after the Bay of Pigs, you know, rightfully so. And also, there were Jupiter missiles already in Turkey, Italy, and the United Kingdom that the United States had pointing at the Soviets. So they were kind of like, well, why can't we do it if the United States is doing it? October 14th, 1962, that was sort of the day that the U-2 overflight of Cuba discovered these Soviet missile sites. The XCOM, the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, began to meet regularly, and the Joint Chiefs started to press for invasion or large-scale airstrikes. This is when we have Curtis LeMay famously telling Kennedy, "You're in a pretty bad fix, Mr. President." And JFK goes, "What'd you say?" And he's like, "Oh, you're in a pretty bad fix. Well, you're right there with me." The audio is not great on that, unfortunately, because they're kind of talking over each other, but it's still pretty cool. Then, of course, the JFK decides to go with the quarantine, which is really just like a limited blockade, which is still an act of war. But The unanimous position of the Joint Chiefs was to invade, and the only one that supported Kennedy with the quarantine blockade was McNamara. And eventually, the quarantine line was tested. The ships, the Soviet ships, did turn back. We've got the story of Vasily Arkhipov with the vetoing that nuclear launch, which is just crazy. There almost was a nuclear missile launched by the Soviets because they were confused about some depth charges, I believe, that had been sent by America. Then on Black Saturday, October 27th, this is really reaches a crescendo. We got two different military personnel that have incidents with the Soviets. One, this guy Maltby, he strays over YouTube. He and his YouTube, he strays over Soviet airspace. And there's a whole conversation, by the way, is like, was that a plant? Did they know about it? Did they let it happen to try to provoke it? There's a kind of a whole side story that I didn't go super far into because it kind of seems speculative, but also possible. I just didn't really know. But at any rate, they were able to get that U-2 out of there, and there was no incident. But then because it could fly higher than the Soviet planes. But then this guy Anderson, I forget his first name, but he was shot down over Cuba. A pilot was shot down over Cuba, Major Anderson, and he died. He was killed. And this is really the point where everyone's freaking out because it's, that's going to force our hand. And also, Kennedy had just said, he had just said, well, if they shoot one of our planes down, then we'll destroy the SAMs, these the anti aircraft missiles. So and then this is when RFK reaches out to Dobrynin and says, hey, the president is not sure that the military won't overthrow him and try to seize power. And RFK had already told Bolshakov a few months before that in August of 1962 that he was worried that in a gust of blind hate, his enemies could go to any length, including killing him. Now, the crisis was ultimately resolved through a secret deal to remove the Jupiter missiles from Turkey. When things calmed down, Khrushchev accepted it on Soviet state radio on October 28th. Most people were excited, relieved, really. The Joint Chiefs were not happy at all. Curtis LeMay called it the greatest defeat in history. That's my 2-minute summary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I guess, what do you think we can learn about the Cuban Missile Crisis, both from Kennedy's interactions with the Joint Chiefs and also just from the things that RFK was telling Dobrynin and Bolshakov via these back channels?
Yeah, a couple of points on that. First of all, you do certainly did bring back some memories with that dialogue. I happened to be in the barber's chair at the time the announcement of the U-2 shoot down came over the radio. We immediately left the barber shop and went home and prepared for the worst because we were living about 50 miles from the first Atlas operational ICBMs, which would have been the first thing on the Russian targeting list. So, like, okay, this afternoon could get worse really quickly. So that brings back some memories. I think one of the things, again, for context, I don't think, and I think most historians now do not really go along with the thought that Khrushchev had Cuba in mind at all in terms of protecting Cuba. Khrushchev had really backed down. Khrushchev really wanted Berlin. Khrushchev really wanted, and he had s such a force superiority that the only thing that held him back was the Soviets well knew that they were way behind on ballistic missiles, tactical missiles, the Thors that you're, so they were well behind on. So how do you negotiate with Kennedy? Even if you think he's a little weak, how do you negotiate with him with U.S. such as a strategic, advantage? Putting those missiles in Cuba neutralized that because it put all of those missile bases within range of Russian missiles in Cuba. Because so you could go into a negotiation saying, we're equal. Yeah, you got lots of missiles, and they're directly under our, preemption. So it would have taken that strategic advantage off the table. What most folks, we didn't even realize at the time, certainly LeMay didn't realize that there were brigades of Russian missile troops in Cuba with cruise missiles, atomic-tipped cruise missiles targeting Guantanamo. There were lots more rocket forces, not just the ballistic missile forces, with nukes in Cuba that the U.S. military was even aware of. Now, the thing is that really differentiates JFK from almost any other president other than Eisenhower. JFK had been a field military officer and saw how real things were out on the front lines. And it, one of his famous quotes during the Cuban Missile Crisis was, "I've got to be talking to the right people." When he sent RFK and McNamara to sink Atlantic's office for a day by hour by hour blow of what were you doing with this quarantine on the Russian ships, his remark was, "Some SOB is not going to get the word, and they're going to take action according to the book. And I don't want action according to the book. You know, the book was built for war. It's not built for, you know, if you follow the book, like depth charging those subs, you're going to get me into a war. I don't want that." That's when RFK and McNamara got into such an argument with the Navy commander. Like, "No, I understand that you've got standing protocols. This does not apply now. You can't do that." So I think the point is, there was a lot of grief because the military and the Joint Chiefs wanted to follow their basic contingency plans, go by the book. Kennedy didn't do that. It's not that he was not hawkish in some senses, but he did not want to go by any pre-programmed book. He was situational. You know, if the Russians blink, no, we're not going to throw the switch if it looks like they're going to. And those dialogues you're talking about with RFK and the Russians, again, I would assert those are to tell the Russians, they're to establish a negotiation. Don't press too hard, or my brother, the president, is going to go harder. You know, you push him, the military will push him. It's not going to do you any good to push him. So I really do think a lot of those exchanges are not, they're political. RFK is a political guy. He's a negotiating guy. They're not necessarily what they seem to be, their positioning. So
Sure.
back to your question, yeah, the Cuban Missile Crisis politically was not good for JFK, but he bounced back from it pretty quickly, and strangely enough, bounced back with just at the end of the Cuban Missile Crisis, or at the Bay of Pigs missile crisis, he bounced back and was starting to transfer a lot of power from the CIA to the military. He was giving military all the covert operations in Indochina and Vietnam. He was about in 60 by 63, he was giving them all the operations against Cuba. So again, JFK has attended more military exercises than any other president. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, yeah, you've got quotes that you can always extract from LeMay. It's easy to get a quote from LeMay. There's no problem with that. Or some, but it that doesn't necessarily portray the situation with the entire military complex. And a lot of
Sure.
it, quite frankly, was political. And as far as the Russian exchanges, may have been positioning for negotiations more than actual fear. Yeah, did JFK fear the influence of the military, a la 7 days in May? Read the book. You know, the one of the Air Force commander will take over and become the president. You know, I don't. He certainly didn't disregard that, but some of that is good positioning too. He supported writing the book and doing the movie. And that's good positioning for him. Like, you know, these guys don't take them, you know. There's another side of this story too, you
There's always a bunch of sides to the story, sometimes more than
know.
two. Sometimes there's all kinds of sides. Let's do something that I'm excited to do, and I don't know what you're going to say. We're going to get Larry Hancock on the record when it comes to Popov's mole. Here we go. Here we go. Here we go. All right. So, Popov's mole. What are we talking about, and who is that? How is it related to the JFK assassination? Okay, so this guy named Peter Popov, he's a GRU colonel who became a CIA defector in place from 1952 to 1959. Then he loses contact with the CIA because he goes back to Moscow. Then he comes back to Germany and he recklessly approaches these British officers in a German restaurant bathroom, and basically gives them information to hand on to the CIA. And turns out MI6 is compromised by the KGB, so this then compromised Popov. So Popov eventually gets discovered and he's executed. But before he's executed, he tells his handler in the CIA, Kiesfalter, I believe his name is, that there is a KGB spy who is high up in the CIA, and he's still there. So then, of course, this starts the mole hunt to try to find the KGB spy and CIA. And here's where Oswald comes in, and he's got some heavy hitters in his corner on this story. Not Oswald, but I guess that there are some heavy hitters who assert this story. According to John Newman, the professor, longtime author researcher, Malcolm Blunt, the esteemed JFK assassination researcher, and legendary CIA officer Pete Bagley, Lee Harvey Oswald was used as bait, or they call it flypaper, to try to catch Popov's mole, because the idea was basically that Oswald's file is held in the Office of Security instead of the Soviet Russia Division, where it should be. The KGB is going to find out about Oswald when he goes and offers this information on the U2. Then they're going to ask their guy at the CIA, "Hey, what's going on with Oswald? Is this real? Is this a provocation?" Then they go check out the file, and then aha, we've caught the person, we've caught our mole. It's the person looking for information on Oswald. Well, no one ever followed up on Oswald. And according to what Newman thinks, it's the reason why is because the guy that was tale as old as time, the guy that was the running the mole hunt, turns out he was the mole. Okay, so that would be why. I don't really want to get into that a ton. It's persuasive to me, but I haven't, zoomed super tight into that. Is Bruce Soley the mole or not? But the whole point is, the headline here is, for our case, is for, as it relates to the assassination, Oswald being a false defector, sort of knowing that he's over there as bait, and it makes sense. He goes over as bait. He doesn't get used. He just sort of fizzles out, and he comes home. So do you share that view? Do you have problems or questions or concerns about the Popov mole theory? What's your take on all that?
Oh, well, okay. I certainly think that there may have been a mole. Just, let's like, certainly there could have been a mole. These people could have been involved. Angleton was obviously concerned about moles in many cases, not just this case. And I think this kind of like Angleton is always, that's his job. I mean, he's always concerned about mole hunting. That's what his whole department exists. When he's doing that part of counterintelligence, he had different roles. So the real question comes is, why would you play this long game with somebody who's relatively unimportant, like Lee Harvey Oswald, who really doesn't have any information that the Soviets are going to want or need? When in the book, The Oswald Puzzle, we look at this and we discovered the HSCA was very interested in the same question long ago, long before John Belushi. They looked at the whole concept of false defectors. They came up, Angleton's office was supplied with details on 11 different individuals that had defected to the Soviet Union. Oswald certainly was not unique. In fact, he's probably the lowest profile. They were technology people like Rand employee Robert Webster. There were others, that guys that had worked for the NSA that were defectors that got a lot more interest inside Russia. There's a lot more paperwork. They were taken seriously. They may have been indeed true false defectors. Webster quite likely was a false defector. We can find documents showing how those people were picked, how they were recruited. how they were prepared for their role, even how they were debriefed by CIA domestic ops when they came back to the US. There's nothing unique about that for Oswald. And as a matter of fact, Oswald doesn't go through any of that process as far as we can find. At most, he may have provided some information through the State Department to domestic ops on his way back to the US. But I guess the real answer to your question is, I think, as with the whole U2 scenario, I love John Newman. I've used a lot of his research. I continue to use it. But I think you can take some of this stuff way too far and build a case around it that doesn't exist. There was nothing unique about Lee Harvey Oswald and the U2. There's nothing unique about Lee Harvey Oswald and mole hunting. Angleton had every ability because he was being copied by State Department. Okay, he's being copied by State Department. The CIA is getting its information about Lee Harvey Oswald from the State Department. They're not getting it anyplace else. They're getting it from the State Department. And then, as Malcolm has pointed out, they control where that information is going. They could have done that with any individual, not just Lee Harvey Oswald. This is a paperwork game played inside it in terms of routing and compartmentalization. So, could Angleton have been playing a mole hunting game with Lee Harvey Oswald's paperwork? Sure. Could have been playing the same game in Mexico City. That doesn't imply that Lee Harvey Oswald is a false defector. He can be a real defector in his own mind, and Angleton can still use his paperwork for mole hunting.
Okay. All right. So what you're saying is you do not believe he was a witting defect, a witting false defector. You believe he was actually a defector, but you're saying it's possible that there could also be layered on top of that someone using him in that role. What about I guess just two things I would bring up just to because here's the deal. You're Larry Hancock, so to be honest with you, like even though I'm not gonna automatically agree with everything you say, I am somewhat like deferential. Like I'm gonna hear you out, okay? I guess my questions would be the routing of Oswald's file. Are there other or you're saying that's not uncommon that someone in his situation would not have their file at Soviet Russia Division? I'm just trying to understand your position on the file routing. Yeah.
This is a routing game, compartmentalization of files, making sure information, for example, we see the same thing, and we go into great detail in the Oswald Puzzle book about information on Oswald being compartmentalized in 1963 between the Cuba Project Special Affairs Staff and Mexico City. There's a special, all of Oswald's files are pulled off of his headquarters file where they should be. Almost all of them are pulled and moved over to the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Okay. So when headquarters is asked about Oswald, Mexico City gets the answer of, well, he's still in the Soviet Union and he may come back with a Soviet wife. No, wait a minute. He's been back for a year. So clearly, this whole point of hiding files, compartmentalizing files, what it really says is this individual may be of interest to some part of the CIA for its own purpose. So much so that they're even monitoring the file traffic and controlling information. So there's nothing unique about controlling information going to Soviet Russia. I mean, it's just another example of how you can control the document flow for that may be for Angleton's purpose in 1961, 62. In 1963, it could be for Angleton's purposes and for Special Affairs Staff purposes because they seem to be isolating information from each other. It's a standard practice, which seems strange, but I mean, this is the an intelligence agency. Control of information is everything.
Sure. I just want to make sure I understand what your position is. So, you're saying that you agree that that his file was handled in an anomalous way. There's something going on with the file, but your position is that that could mean a number of things. But don't you think they would have tried to explain it if it had an innocent explanation? I guess because it's so obvious.
And that's a great question, but here's the answer. It's 1964 or later during the House Select Committee. You, as the CIA officer, do you want to come up and give testimony that the CIA was considering Oswald, not only just considering Oswald, but using Oswald without his knowledge, but using Lee Harvey Oswald for a variety of different operational purposes internally? We're totally familiar with the guy. We're all over him. We have several officers that, are handling this information. This gets worse in 1963 when David and I write in our book. He's actually being considered for two different operational uses. One of them is supposed to kick off in November 1963. Do you really want to go into committee and testify about that? It's not a
Well,
good look.
it's not a good look, but one would think that, like, I don't know, if I was on the lone nut side of the game, an easy win would be to go and get that from the CIA and be like, look, here we're gonna come clean and tell you what we did. So look, all you conspiracy people, shut up. I'm just saying, I don't know.
The CIA never comes clean.
They're, I
It
guess they're
just
not.
doesn't work that way. Again,
Everyone
one of
thinks
the
they killed
things that
Kennedy, though, is the problem.
one of the things that again we see in 1963 is this, and this has just come out a lot with the recent file releases. There were so many people in Miami, special affairs staff, JM Wife, domestic ops officers, that are absolutely know about Lee Harvey Oswald. They're tracking him. They're getting information on his activities from their sources. And after, when they're asked for testimony, no, nobody ever heard of them. No, we never heard of this guy. We've found out that after the assassination, special affairs staff even conducted their own investigation of their own people to see if they were involved, and then destroyed the report.
Right.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so the CIA, no, I'm sorry, it just doesn't come up front with this stuff. If you think that JFK was going to quote unquote break the agency into a thousand pieces before his assassination, if you come out with this knowledge of Oswald and, oh, by the way, he just killed JFK, he's de somebody's definitely going to break the agency into a thousand pieces.
So are you saying that Oswald, sorry, I just want to make sure I'm getting your point. Is it that he might have had been some sort of low level, like witting asset of some extent, and we just don't know? Or are
So
you saying you're ruling that out, and if he was involved, it was unwitting? I guess that's my question.
and we have a whole chapter on that in the book. That's because that's the question you've got to answer. We can't dance around that one. The answer is no, he was never a witting asset. Oswald was following his own agenda, but his own agenda made him useful at various times to different people within the CIA and to the FBI. What we would assert actually is there was one government agency, the FBI, who actually was considering Oswald as a provisional subversive informant in the summer of 1963 because he had gone to them and offered them information about the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and this secret cell within New Orleans. And for about, oh, 2 months, they actually were treating him as a source. And Oswald did that to throw them off because he didn't want to mess in his business in New Orleans, and it worked. By the time they caught to the fact that he had misled them, he was gone. He was out of town. And it actually did divert them for a couple. So our position is Oswald had his own agendas, played his own games. There were people around him that were doing things with information about him that he had no clue about.
Got it. Okay. All right. No, that's, I mean, what I like about your point is that it's plausible, and it's a very Larry Hancock thing to say, honestly. But because you're not just going la 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 la, what are you talking about? There's nothing happened. You're going, hold on, something may have happened, but you can't necessarily draw the conclusion you're trying to draw from that. Although perhaps one can. We'll see. All right, let's move on to the next thing here. Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, but this guy that I know, let's just say, is. So whether you're like me or the guy I know, or you're really into weed, whatever it is, you're about to nerd out big because there's this company called Mood, Mood.com, that's changing the way people buy cannabis. Here's the science, and this is the part I love. The reason different cannabis strains make you feel different ways isn't just about THC, it's also based on other components called terpenes. Terpenes influence how your bud tastes and smells, but they also affect what you feel. So one terpene might make you feel uplifted and energetic, and another one makes you relaxed and sleepy. There are dozens of these. So when you have the right combination of terpenes, you can feel social, focused, creative, aroused, chilled out, or whatever. You just go to mood.com, click Shop by Mood, and that's it. Want to be more social at a party? There's flower for that. Need to focus and get more work done? There's flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep. Flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and comes in a discreet box. Best of all, everything is backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code JFK. So head to mood.com and get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. Former C, I want to talk about James Woolsey. Are you familiar with this book that he wrote? It's
Yes.
like 120 pages. It's really, really short. But it has a nice texture on the hardcover sleeve, I will say. But anyway, Woolsey was a former CIA director, and he basically writes a book about how, hey, guess what? It really was the Soviets. It's basically the book of of the LBJ theory, the story that that he was telling the Warren Commission the whole time. And because there is evidence that was made to look this way, sort of how I've now come to see all this. It's like, yeah, it looks a lot like the Soviets had the exact involvement Woolsey's alleging, because that seems to have been like a subplot, like the second layer of the onion, if you will, to sort of get all the commissioners on board to stick to the official story. And Woolsey says that his theory is that Khrushchev personally ordered the assassination, and that his handlers of Oswald was de Morenschild and Valery Khostakov. Now, de Morenschild clearly is associated with American intelligence and French intelligence, I believe, but I don't think there's really any evidence of that. I didn't see any evidence proffered by Woolsey showing de Morenschild being a Soviet spy, but Khostakov, that's the big famous one. Okay, he's the guy who's supposed to be Department 13, the head of assassinations in the Western Hemisphere for the Soviets. And we have our only one and only rebuttal in this episode. I'm going to drop in right here, Larry, and this is from Fred in Louisiana, and he's calling me out on not mentioning something about Khostakov, which I think I did mention this in the Mexico City episode, but I probably should have brought it up again. And here's what it is. He says, you slid by a substantial controversy on Khostakov. Check out his 1964, or check out the 1964 communication from Hoover to Angleton about Khostakov. At the time, Angleton and others in the CIA appeared to be pushing the idea that Oswald acted on behalf of the Soviets under Khostakov's direction. In memos to the Warren Commission, the CIA used the language, it is believed that Khostakov was associated with Directorate 13, not he was. So, in other words, he's saying it's really an unresolved controversy if Khostakov even held this position that makes it the headline that he, because if it's like, oh, Khostakov talked to the Soviets at the embassy, well, who cares? He's been to the Soviet Union before. But if he talked to the head of wet works of the KGB, oh my gosh, this is a crisis. So that makes a big difference. And I will answer that rebuttal by very bravely t saying, I'm going to go out on a limb and I'm going to say, Larry, what's your take?
Okay, yeah. Well, let's see. There are two questions there. I think there are two questions there. What I will say is, Kostikov, what we know basically is, as with the CIA officers, every embassy, whether it's U.S. or Russian or British or whatever, the political officers at that embassy are either intelligence officers, or they've been trained by intelligence officers. The people that Oswald met with, Kostikov, those guys were intelligence officers. There's no doubt about that. What we know about Kostikov's actual role was Kostikov was in Mexico City to interface with Soviet informants working out of the U.S. And we actually have a paper trail of the CIA handing off a European Soviet source who came to the U.S. They handed it off to the FBI, and then that fellow crossed the border into the Mexico to report to Kostikov on his activities in the U.S., which actually had to do with missile bases, not just missile bases, but the missile base I mentioned earlier, 50 miles southwest of me in Oklahoma, which I loved. Okay. Kostikov was an intelligence officer in charge of assassinations. I think that's, we have nothing to prove that. He was an intelligence officer whose role was to talk to Americans who would either be already known Soviet sources or potential Soviet sources. And one thing that people have got to understand is if an American shows up at the gate of a Soviet embassy or a Russian shows up at the gate of an American embassy on Saturday, there's an intelligence officer that's going to talk to them because that's when all the real defections occur. And there is a huge amount of documentation for that. That's, you don't want regular staff around on the weekend, so whoever's going to defect or try to establish contact shows up. Kostikov meeting with Oswald and they're taking the time to meet with Oswald absolutely makes total sense. It has nothing to do with assassinations, has to do with defections. So I would come down on the fact Kostikov is simply an intelligence officer. He is KGB, without a doubt. And the several levels at the CIA were quite frankly trying to point towards the Soviet Union in the 2 weeks after the assassination and longer. Wolseley's saying it's nothing new. What I found fascinating about Wolseley's book is there's a book by Hugh MacDonald, was written way before Wolseley. It's titled LBJ and the JFK Conspiracy, and it presents details on how the Soviets corrupted LBJ and brought him into a plot, and the Soviets are behind this. And in his book, MacDonald even gives Politburo documents for the Politburo approving the assassination of Kennedy over Cuba. You know, it's like, wait a minute, Wolseley's just way behind the curve on this. No, I'm sorry. I think Wolseley's book is just, it's kind of like Phillips' book. No CIA officer is ever going to write for decades about this without trying to point it towards the Soviets.
Right. Well, do you think this the conversation about Kostikov being head of assassinations, that that's an honest misunderstanding? Gee, like a telephone game and it somehow got in there? Or do you think that got planted in the record?
I think it's a diversion, quite frankly, by the CIA. Yeah. They were seriously trying to, which you've got to, who do you want people to be looking at? Do you want to be looking at my agent? See, or you want them to be looking at the bad guys, the guys we fight. We want them to be looking over there. That gets us into the Alvarado story, Phillips, a lot of other things going on. And a black propaganda op against the Soviets. That's another story, and it's in the book. But anyway, that short, I never give a short answer, you know that, but there's an answer to your question.
Sure. Let's talk about I want to just kind of touch on Woolsey's theory a little bit and the main some of the main arguments behind it. One of his strongest pieces of evidence, and one of the strongest pieces of evidence, sort of in support of this idea that Oswald was in fact working with the Soviets, is this this November 9th, 1963 letter to the Soviet embassy. It's handwritten, and the handwritten draft Ruth Payne turned over to the authorities. It's typed on a typewriter at Ruth Payne's house. The only typed document the FBI could establish had been made on it. That doesn't mean it was a problem, but then anyway. So the letter, what it says, is the issue, right? And so here's the sort of the spicy part. He references Comrade Kostin, which is apparently Kostakov's code name. And then I say apparently because it's like, well, Kostakov was supposedly the head of KGB assassinations, and we just determined that wasn't true. But anyway, so the letter references Kostin, and which is Kostakov's code name, and says, quote, "I had not planned to contact the Soviet embassy in Mexico, so they were unprepared. Had I been able to reach the Soviet embassy in Havana as planned, the embassy there would have had time to complete our business." So the "as planned" and the "our business" kind of makes it sound like, hey, you understand what we're talking about. We have a deal. We have a thing going on here. There's like a hidden understanding. And on its face, it does look like that. Either that's what was going on, or it was made to look like that, it would seem. But there are some issues with the letter, including November 9th, that this letter talks about the removal of the Cuban consulate, Eusebio Askew, but it's 9 days before it actually happened. And then there's also Hoover's direct admission to LBJ that, they had the tape and the photos, and they had the men, the FBI folks interviewed Oswald, and it's not the same guy on the tape. There's a second person down there. Plus Jane Roman, Ann Eggertor, Tom Karamessinis, all knowingly sending an outdated Oswald file to Mexico City Station, which you mentioned earlier. We'll come back to that here. Also, we've got Marvin Giesling, one of the unsung heroes of Oswald obfuscation, on October 9th, turning off the FBI flash on Oswald that would have been sort of triggered the next day. Of course, the Soviet ambassador's response to this in a contemporaneously written memo that he sent back to the Kremlin was that this letter was a provocation, most likely by the people who actually did it. And of course, people can always say, well, of course they're writing that for the record, and you believe what the Soviets wrote, dummy. So I understand. I get it. What are your thoughts on all of those things as it relates to the letter in Mexico City, Kostakov, Oswald, etc.?
Well, let's take a look as if Oswald wrote it, and Oswald's use of pronouns, because we and are and that's a big part of it. That's one of the things that you've got to remember is that Lee and Marina jointly had started writing the Russians in New York City since the end of 1962, or starting early 1963. They sent him a Christmas card, end of 1962, and they start a regular series of correspondence to them, both Lee and Marina, talking about their going back to Russia. Okay. Marina wants to go back. She starts her paperwork to go back. There are more letters from New Orleans talking about, Marina's pregnant. They need to expedite her paperwork. Marina writes why she hadn't responded with the requested information quickly enough. It's a lot of we are going, our plans are to go back to the Soviet Union. Then we get a letter from Oswald again from New Orleans saying, well, she's pregnant. She needs to come back. She wants to have her baby in Russia. I don't have to come back with her. I can come back later. We can, we need to get her back. I can follow along. So if you look at that letter from the we and our business as a family, as far as Lee is concerned, is to get at least Marina and June back to the Soviet Union. He's fed up with the U.S. It didn't work out the way he planned it. Nobody's paying any attention to him, and And then you get him to Mexico City. His plan and what he tells the Cubans are, I need to get a visitor visa to go to Cuba while we're trying to get Marina back to Russia, trying to get my wife back to Russia. And I don't feel comfortable in the U.S. I want to be there while we're handling our business to get her back to Russia. So the we and our refers to a family matter. As far as notifying, he has been corresponding with the Russian embassy in New York City, okay? Not the Russians in New Mexico, in Mexico City. But they quickly find out about his correspondence when they query New York City. So they know that this is in process, and they give him the real story and push back on him. So the bottom line is twofold. The letter makes perfect sense in context of what Oswald has been trying to do for 9 months with Marina. It makes perfect sense in what he told the Cubans in Mexico City and what he told the Russians in Mexico City. Now, what the other point that you brought up is, how does he know about Askew? One of the things that people largely ignore is the fact that Sylvia Duran was handled by the CIA and kept from offering testimony immediately to the Warren Commission. We didn't hear from Sylvia Duran and what she had to say when we should have, solely because of the CIA intervention in Mexico City. What she later said is Duran said, "Yeah, I told Oswald his application was going to be filed. I sent him out to get pictures. He came back with pictures. We completed the safe paperwork in a package. Then he got into an argument with Askew, but I told him his paperwork would be forwarded to consideration. I also told him he would be advised if that visa was granted." When she was questioned by the HSCA, she said, yes, his visa had been granted. They said, "Did you advise him by mail or phone as to the status of his visa being granted and he'd be allowed to travel?" And all she would say is, "I don't remember." There is the possibility that he had been advised that Askew wasn't a problem. Askew had not managed to hold it up based on what Duran had said. The interesting thing is, I asked Hostie about this personally one point in time, and he told me his FBI buddies had actually found the visa, approved visa for travel to Cuba. And I said, "But they never, that's not on record. It's not in the documents." And he said, "I don't care. That's what they told me, that yes, his visa had indeed been granted," which is the same thing Duran said.
Wow, what was James Hostie like? Just a quick sidebar. What was your impression of him?
My impression with him was he was pretty straightforward. He was very upset with the way the FBI had handled him, the way Hoover had handled him. He said he told me things and said things that his friends in the FBI in Mexico City and in New Orleans were knew things about Lee Harvey Oswald and had been monitoring Oswald that they didn't go on record with. Hoover wouldn't let them go on record with. They wouldn't, and which absolutely perfectly tallied with what we found out about Oswald actually being a PSI in New Orleans. I took Hostie as pretty straightforward, telling the truth and being badly managed. I was amazed to find out that Hostie, when Oswald was arrested in New Orleans, the FBI reported that to F New Orleans, to FBI headquarters. FBI headquarters immediately queried Dallas and Hostie, and had Hostie send his whole background file, which they sent to the CIA in headquarters in DC, and which DC sent to Miami. Again, more evidence that these guys in Miami later lied through their teeth when they said, "Noswell who?"
Right.
Okay. So I found Hostie to be the one thing that I asked him about. And I asked him about this. It said, "Jim, what you just told was on one point of Oswald being known and, used used by the FBI or potentially used by the FBI. So it's like, could you, there's actually a piece of paper, a document that I sent to him. Would you certify this document? And he wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it in writing. He wouldn't do it on the phone. It's like he would, I passed it to him through his daughter. And then I call him on the, he's like, yeah, didn't we? He would talk about anything other than something that confirmed what he was telling me in writing, because he's still out of pension, I think, quite frankly. And Hoover and the Bureau, you just don't risk your pension.
Sure. Hey, one thing I want to just to tie a bow on this conversation about the letter. How would you explain Oswald's usage of the word Kostin instead of Kostakov? Because Woolsey presents it as if that's a secret name, and the mere usage of Kostin, it demonstrates that Oswald had some sort of operative knowledge.
Well, A, first of all, it makes absolutely no sense that anybody would give Oswald a secret name for Kostakov. You don't disclose crypts, you don't disclose aliases, and you certainly don't allow that to be used in correspondence. So that why would if he names Kostakov by his true name in a letter, that's enough. There's no need to you play spy games. That's just silliness.
Yeah.
So that's my immediate reaction. That's something Woolsey might know. I don't know. I can't explain that, only that it doesn't make sense for, if you want to make this guy as director of assassinations, your director of assassinations is not sharing a code name
Sure.
with Lee Harvey Oswald.
Is it probably possible that Kostin was not his code name, and that Oswald just got the name wrong,
That
and then Woolsey took it and ran with it and said, "Aha!"
Oswald had what is constant with Oswald. We wouldn't call it dyslexia. I wouldn't want to call it that. Oswald was a terrible speller. Oswald's really bright. He's a great reader. When you look at his IQ test and that sort of stuff, he reads well. He tests well in reading and verbally, does well in interviews, but his writing is terrible. He misspells, he gets, and it, I don't think it is literally a misspelling. I think the speculation is that he's not processing the character. So, yes, I think it's very likely that, I mean, he's in a meeting with this guy. He does use the correct name when he calls back to the Soviet embassy and talks about having met with Costa. Oh, sorry, I'm sorry, he did that. He calls back and talks about having met with Soviets. The Soviet person uses the name Kostakov. That may be the only time Lee Harvey Oswald even hears the name Kostakov. When he's writing the letter 2 months later, does he remember Kostakov? Does he remember Kostin? It could be memory. It could be handwriting. I can't say. I don't find it terribly suspicious, given all his other writing mistakes, basically.
Let's move on to the question of whether or not Lyndon Johnson subjectively believed that there was a Soviet conspiracy going on at the time of the assassination and shortly thereafter. And then sort of Johnson's getting into sort of, Johnson using this with the Warren Commission, et cetera. Post-assassination, he's at Parkland Hospital talking about, there being a Soviet conspiracy, and asking, when they're going to get out of there. He seems like he's all worried about that. And then as soon as which it's the craziness of the day, et cetera, assuming LBJ didn't have foreknowledge, which I'm not sure how I feel about that. I'm not an LBJ as a planner guy. That's not me, but I do, wouldn't surprise me if someone was like, "Hey, man," just to let him know, because he's gonna have to quarterback the cover up, in the future. Anyway, I'm saying if of course there was a conspiracy. Then we have LBJ's right hand man, Cliff Carter. He's making calls to Henry Wade, to Wagner Carr, to Jesse Curry, all that night, warning them not to go, down the conspiracy road. And then of course the next morning, This is the famous call with Hoover, which the tape is provably erased, intentionally erased. They still have the artifacts from it, and it's about 17, I think, minutes, 17 to 18 minutes of tape that is totally gone, but they have the artifacts all the way through. Whereas it's like every 6 seconds there's like a tenth of a second sound or something like that. I did the exercise of reading the transcript and what I, a reasonable pace, and it ended up being about 6 minutes. So now, but if you look at the transcript and you try to figure out, okay, what did they cut out? There's not a super clear cut point, although, anything could be I mean, if you take out all the context, anything could be a clear cut point. So anyway, I say that to say, the headline in the transcript, that's what we do have, is, Johnson follows up about, well, what about, Oswald down there at the Soviet embassy? And then Hoover says, well, that's the thing. It looks like it was a second person down there because the voice doesn't match and the face doesn't match. He then, fa and this is what I find to be strange, because everybody goes, well, it wasn't that. It was another thing. But what I find to be strange is that Hoover follows it up with a written memo to the White House and also to the Secret Service. So it's not like this is just a hunch or a vibe. But then it's never discussed again. It's not like it's brought up and he goes, hey, remember we talked about this? We were wrong. It was not that. So, that was weird that we thought that. That was dumb. So there's that. And then there's also, of course, the ODO incident that puts Oswald in Dallas. And I know I believe you and I had talked about this before, and you had problems with the basically confirming the ODO incident, et cetera. But at a minimum, it looks like someone's, and Matt could be wrong, you could tell me, but it looks like someone's trying to impersonate Oswald at that point. If it's not, either he's being impersonated in Mexico City or he's being impersonated in Dallas. I guess my question is, do you think Oswald was ever impersonated in Mexico City? Some people there, because basically there's three camps. There's Oswald never went to Mexico City at all. There's Oswald was there. There's no shenanigans whatsoever. Every time it says it was Oswald, it was Oswald. And then the third camp, which I think is the John Newman Jefferson Morley camp. I could be wrong, Morley, if I'm getting your. I know John Newman doesn't watch this, but Morley might. So if I'm getting your position wrong, sorry. But that position, I think, is like Oswald did go to Mexico City, but he also was impersonated there once because he, like, for whatever reason, he was impersonated on at least one occasion, but he did go. That's the third position. So where do you fall on that spectrum of Mexico City?
Okay, two questions then. On the first question, Johnson and the Soviets. Quick answer, Johnson never believed it was the Soviets. Johnson chose not to talk to his Secretary of Defense or his military liaison for hours. Johnson, if you look at his war record, it's not a, well, let's say, bravery is not on the record anywhere, so I disbelieve the fact that he thought he was personally at risk or anybody else was at risk. Really, that was just bogus. If you read someone would talk, I'm making the case in about three chapters where Johnson had been approached beforehand by someone connected with Johnny Roselli, not brought into the conspiracy, but told that he's not going to have to worry about the congressional investigation that's going on, which is what he's really worried about. He won't have to worry about that, but it would be good, if something happens to forestall that, if he, basically just shut it down, which is exactly what he did. But so that's the first question. On Mexico City, okay.
Just real quick, was that Jack Halfin that is the one that relayed that from Roselli to LBJ?
No, it was, oh, his, was Roselli's, basically representative in DC. He was a consultant,
Okay.
political consultant. I should remember the name, but it wasn't Halpern. No.
Irving Davidson?
No, not Davidson. Oh darn. The guy lived like a block away from Hoover. He was that
Okay.
upscale.
Yeah,
And
yeah, yeah.
he and Bobby Baker actually had a meeting with in Johnson's office if it had gone into the Baker scandal record, and I found it
Right.
in Johnson's meeting notes, he would have been dead meat, basically, for that whole scandal. But back to your question. What we present in the Oswald household is Oswald was at ODEO's, and that's one of the keys to the whole conspiracy, which we just elaborated on in the two chapters that we added to the paperback edition that just shipped, as to why that's the key to the conspiracy. Oswald was impersonated in Mexico City by the CIA itself with a pretext call, because they're trying to determine who this American at the Cuban and the Soviet embassies is, because they don't know who he is. They've just, they've intercepted calls saying there's an American there. The Cuban's talking about him. Duran's talking about him. Who is he? Standard practice, which I document that they used all the time, was to do a pretext call representing themselves as the person trying to get information from the embassy to like to name them or give some. So yes, he was. But then afterwards, the CIA had to cover that up for a variety of reasons, ending up in the fact that the CIA had to tell the House Select Committee that everything that the Tarasovs, the interpreters, were telling them about a suppressed transcript, that Phillips was telling them that the HSCA should not take anything that Phillips said as viable. And he's the guy who's in charge of all of this. It's so stupid. Like, they can't. He's telling them this stuff occurred, and they're going, ignore him. He doesn't know what he's talking about.
So you're saying, so Oswald, you said, did meet Odio. You think that was him? And then he, and
Yes.
then what, the timeline is such that he could then also go to Mexico City?
Yeah, the timeline is so iffy over the space of 3 or 4 days, especially with the presumption the official story of how he got to Mexico City by bus isn't necessarily all true, which I do not believe. There are lots of holes in that timeline. Certainly, it's an open issue. I can't say it's definitively, but if someone was driving him to McCowan's and then to ODEO's and then to Houston, there's plenty of time for all those meetings and to get him across the border. And you still got the border agent report, who within 24 hours was quoted by the press as saying, oh yeah, I passed Lee Oswald through the checkpoint. He was driven through with these two guys. Yeah, not the, oh, well, that's not exactly a bus trip, is it? And you never heard from the man again. I think it's great. It's like he disappears.
Right.
So yeah, I think the ODEO story is true and very critical, especially given who her uncle was, the only person who would have had her telephone number. And it's the same guy who had been in the courtroom with Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans just weeks earlier. Johnson, I don't trust him. Johnson aborts conspiracy because he knows it's in his best interest. And yes, Oswald was impersonated, but by the CIA for reasons they later chose to cover up, which are
Got it.
extreme. We go into extreme detail in the book
Okay.
on.
All right. I owe you, hopefully you'll come back on again once I've read through the Oswald puzzle from start to finish, because I look forward to doing that. Well, let me just ask you then, with Johnson, do this Hoover call makes it seem like Johnson's understanding should be that where it's left is that Oswald's impersonated there, and that, hey, it wasn't Oswald meeting with the Soviets, because you just told Hoover just told me it wasn't that. But then we got the recording with Richard Russell, most famously, where he's saying, let me tell you about a little incident in Mexico City that Hoover told me about. Well, Hoover told you that that incident was false. So either something else happened at some other time, and he said, oh, that thing, and he kind of told him it wasn't the case afterwards. Now, if that's true, they didn't pull any of the memos back that were part of the record, or LBJ knew that that was a lie, yet he used it because he knew that it was convincing to get people to do what he wanted. So what's your take on that?
My take is that the part of the conversation I think that's most important is perhaps not even, it's Hoover saying it appears that Oswald was associated with other people. You know, he's impersonated, but you know, that doesn't mean that he wasn't in Mexico City. It means somebody's impersonated him on, which is all Hoover knew at that point in time, which is true, if I'm right about that pretext call. But I think the real ticker for Johnson is that, you know, Hoover is bringing up conspiracy. Hoover, when the Warren Commission, the FBI makes its report, the FBI actually asks Johnson if they could include some language that they're still investigating Cuban involvement in a conspiracy with Oswald. Johnson pushes back, says, no, you can't do that. Hoover twice asked him to include something about conspiracy that, you know, where we're looking into it. Johnson's not accepting anything about conspiracy. So I think what that call is about is Hoover is telling Johnson something Johnson really doesn't want to hear, because he's busily, as you said, with calls from Carter that night before, he is busily going to be doing everything he can to suppress any discussion of conspiracy. And what's missing out of the call, I suspect, is you remember that by the next morning at about 10 o'clock, Hoover issues a memo which essentially closes the case and directs everyone, if you're interviewing anyone with a lead or anyone who might be suspected, other than someone directly associated with Lee Harvey Oswald, who can offer, you know, testimony as to his guilt, we don't want to hear it. We're done. And the next afternoon, he tells someone to write a report saying the investigation is done. So this is all part of Johnson essentially telling him, I suspect he told him on the phone just to stop it. You know, we need to focus on him. We don't need to focus on these other people. We need to focus on, and Johnson starts to deliver his thing. I don't want to face a war with the Soviets. I don't want to make things, you know, I think what's missing, and Hoover's, you know, being irascible in his own terms, tries to avoid that for a while and say, would you at least let me bring the Cubans into it? And Johnson's going, no, not that either. But does
Yeah.
that answer your question?
No, that does. That does. So basically, I mean, would you, so it's safe to say that Johnson knew that it was, regardless of whether or not Oswald was impersonated, Johnson knew that it wasn't true that Oswald had met with the head of assassinations and was a threat. But
Right.
he used that anyway.
He used that anyway, just like he used 40 million dead. I mean, he went to the trouble to call the chairman of the AEC to get an estimate of how many dead in a first strike from the Soviets to use with informing the war. I mean, Johnson was playing that card. I mean, the Chief Justice, former Chief Justice, does not leave Johnson's office in tears without Johnson having said something very compelling to him. This the fix was in. I'll go on record being contrarian. We constantly get led astray by saying, you know, by the conspiracy and the cover up may be connected via Johnson, but that's all. Johnson's goal was to quash any sign of conspiracy, and he was very effective at that.
Yeah. So, because he wanted to have a presidency, because he wanted to preside over something other than just the nuclear ashes that would be left. So, all right, let's thank you for your time. You've been with me for a while and I appreciate it. We just got a few more things to cover here. I want to talk about some of the things that have come out from the new Russian document disclosure, the one that Congresswoman Luna got from the Russians. Now, of course, the disclaimer is, hey, Russia is our current geopolitical foe and we're engaged in an armed conflict. I asked Claude if I could call the Ukraine a proxy war, and it said that it's not exactly that, and I should call it something else. So anyway, the point is, Ukraine is being backed financially by the United States, and against the Soviets, or I mean against Russia, and they're the ones giving us this, you know, information. So, you know, probably in the context of like, hey, look, we did nice things before working together. It's sort of a reminder of what we can do again. That's sort of what the analysts have said, which I find hilarious because it's like, man, that harkens back to a time when people like read books and like poetry and like thought. Nobody cares about anything from the past at all. The idea that anyone would have like empathy or like care about someone or what someone did before, like, and what the symbolism is, like, LOL, that is, those days are gone. Anyway, yeah, what I wanted to get at though is some of the main findings. So the first one, probably the headline, the Dear Mr. Hunt letter, we can put it to bed. It's over. It's officially a provocation from the KGB. And the whole question was, hey, is this H.L. Hunt or is this E. Howard Hunt? Which was kind of funny because the KGB didn't really see that coming. They thought it was going to be E. Howard Hunt, that everyone would obviously think it was. But the December 1960 letter was intercepted by the KGB. We now have that letter. And they just took some of the phrases from that letter to make the Dear Mr. Hunt letter. What is your assessment of what that means, I guess? Because you could kind of look at that and go, well, you could look at it a couple different ways. You could go, well, obviously Oswald killed Kennedy, and here's the KGB just trolling to make, just to sort of inject disinformation and make the CIA look bad. Or you could say, well, the CIA had some sort of involvement and doesn't have totally clean hands. And here's their nemesis pointing out their lack of clean hands and trying to raise, bring attention to it, even though what they're doing is tricky and not legit, their methodology of doing that. So how do you look at that?
I believe that is all intelligence agencies love disinformation. It's like in the handbook. It's what we do, and we always want to point fingers at the other guy. I mean, that's just, it's in the booklet. This is what we do. Here's your task. There's somebody in propaganda that's waiting to do that. The CIA did it. The Russians did it. I think, as you said, it certainly, although I will say Mary Farrell told me 20 years ago that when she was looking at the Hunt letter, she had sent a couple of people to Mexico City just with the address, the postage, where it was stamped, what post office it was sent from, and the fact that it was within 2 blocks of the Soviet embassy suggested to her okay, but yeah, we can put that to bed. I think the more important thing about this is the information I think that we can trust out of the Soviet files is the information that Titovits got back in the 90s when there was a detente, when the Russians were opening up their files and they really didn't care that the KGB had gone away. This before the FSB succeeded the KGB. There's a transition time then when it's like, we don't care. We're going to be capitalist. We're going to be buddies. Here, if you want to. And Titovits got just a ton of internal documentation on how the KGB handled Oswald, how the Politburo handled Oswald, because frankly, he was more of a political embarrassment for them than anything else. So basically, I would say I trust, for real insight into Oswald, I would trust the files that he got and wrote about and references in his book more than what we're seeing now. And nobody got, he got, actually, he got some files talking about the KGB surveillance on Oswald in Minsk, which is not in anything that we were given in the current releases to Luna.
Wow. I want to talk about another document that's in this release, which we already knew about this because it's I mean I became aware of it from reading David Talbot's Brothers, but it's this the story of William Walton going over in December of 1963 and talking with Bolshakov, basically carrying a message, going as an emissary on behalf of Bobby Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy. Now, it's really, he already had a scheduled trip over there and he was already planning to go to Moscow. So it's not like Bobby Kennedy sent him. But it seems to also be true that this was like one of JFK's best friends. Like he was close with Kennedy, Walton. I believe he was in his wedding. Walton goes over, meets with Bolshakov, and he tells him that that undoubtedly the assassination was the result of a large political conspiracy. Now, it's not totally clear, whether or not that part of the conversation came from RFK. Like, did RFK tell me to tell you that he thinks this, or is it me saying that I think this? But even William Walton, who is that close to the Kennedy, regardless of whether or not it's sanctioned by RFK and Jackie, probably Jackie didn't sanction him to say that, I would imagine. But maybe RFK did. But either way, the mere fact of William Walton saying it seems notable. What's your take on that interaction?
Two things. I don't think it was, as you say, I don't think it was a specific message. Being he's not sent to deliver this message. It's a conversation. And he's asked a question, who's not going to be talking about this, right? You just came from DC. What's the gossip? And I don't think there were very few people, I think, in Washington, DC, insiders. There are few people inside the CIA. There are few people almost anywhere that didn't think there was a conspiracy. I mean, you could talk to just about anybody. They might point you in different directions, but they saw it as a politically oriented regime change, whatever you want to call it. We know that RFK thought that because he had his personal friends start doing investigations on who it might be. So, we know if RFK thought, or he told that to Walters or not, almost doesn't matter. It would be the conversation that was in play. There's every reason to think that Jackie felt that way. If so, the Manchester interviews would still not be suppressed. I mean, the biggest smoking gun you got right now is what Jackie Kennedy told Manchester that estate won't release. That forget everything else that Luna's doing. Jackie's suspicions were probably right on target, and I do not believe that in any event. So I think the Walters thing is just it reflects the fact, honestly, that there was a general knowledge that there was some sort of conspiracy in play that almost nobody really wanted to reveal. We're embarrassed, we're in shock, we're it's better not to know. It's almost like, don't tell the kids there's no Santa Claus. We thought we had an open democratic form of government. We don't. Okay, we missed it. Everybody, you just didn't want to say that in public. You didn't want to admit it, which is why we come up with all the, oh, I knew this, but I didn't tell it to the Warren Commission, because the family didn't want me to go into it. It's better that we just let it lie. JFK's aides, his friends will tell you that. That they, yeah, did we see evidence of a shot from the front? Yeah, but it was just, it was not something, it was bad enough at the time. Just don't go there.
Yeah.
That's what I see it as.
All right, one last discussion point here, which is Bill Truesdale. You ever heard of him? This is a guy who is obscure, a very obscure figure, brand new in the game. This is a guy who died in 2025, and he shared his diary with, or his estate, his caregiver, shared his diary with Jefferson Morley, who went through it and wrote a story on how Truesdale saw Lee Harvey Oswald on a train from Helsinki to Moscow in 1959. Truesdale was going to Afghanistan for some archaeology trip. And the headline is that Oswald told him he was going to visit the Soviet Union for 5 days, then he was going to start college at a college in Switzerland. So, to me, I look at that and I go, Albert Schweitzer College, the home of, Percival Brundage, the chief funder, who's, according to the New York Times, up to his eyeballs with the CIA. He's one of the OG owners of Southern Air Transport, which eventually was sold to my backyard of Columbus, Ohio, with Les Wexner and Jeffrey Epstein eventually. So, long story short, the question is, why is Oswald like, I'm just trying to get your take on what's happening there, because Oswald wasn't going to Albert Schweitzer College. He's lying to a person he doesn't even know. What's the point of lying? What's the value of lying, I guess? And Also, while we're talking about it, what was up with Albert Schweitzer College if it wasn't some sort of like intelligence front for Os, you know, to give Oswald a fake reason to go over to the Soviet Union?
This is great. This is where you get another chance to be contrarian. He wasn't lying. He was telling the truth. We go into great detail in that in the book. The reason Oswald, if you look at his application to Albert Schweitzer, if you look at it, written application, what he wants to major in, the course he's going to take, so on and so forth, it's perfectly consistent with what Oswald's personal agenda is, what he wants to study. He wants to be a writer. He wants to get into international global politics. And it's the same sort of stuff he will be writing about in the spring of 1963. It's absolutely consistent with that. The thing is, he had enrolled to start at Albert Schweitzer in the spring, the fall. He's still in the Marines. So he's going to go into Albert Schweitzer the spring after he's. Gets out. His enlistment is up in the fall. Okay. So that makes perfect sense. He'll be out for a couple of months. He'll go to Albert Schweitzer, go to college. Then he gets a letter saying, or then he goes home on leave and find out his mom's been injured and is not working anymore. He immediately puts in, he starts sending money to her, puts in for an early discharge, and gets it. Okay. So suddenly he's at home 6 months early. He has nothing to do. He really wants to go, he wants to go to Europe. He wanted to travel in Europe. He wanted to go to Germany. He's got a German language book that he's studying, continuing to study. But he's at home with his mom, and he finds out his mom basically isn't injured anymore. She can go back to work. Okay. So, all right. And he doesn't really like his mother anyway. I mean, we got to be honest about that if you go into Oswald. He and she never got along very well. So what's he going to do? Is he going to stay home, or is he going to go ahead? And so what he does is he tells mom he's going to New Orleans. He's going to go back and look for a job in the import-export business where he was a runner and a courier before. And instead, he books a trip overseas. And so he is going to go to Russia because he wants to see Russia. He's interested in Russia. He's reading Russian literature. And I think his statement on the train was absolutely true. He goes to Russia. He intends to stay in Russia for, the extent of his tourist visa is concerned. And then he's going to go back and start to school at Albert Schweitzer. While he's in Russia, some things start to happen to him. First, he gets turned on to a couple of in-tourist girls, okay? And he starts going, this is interesting. And they're taking good care of me. And then things happen. The Russians themselves say, no, you can't overstay. We're not going to extend your visa. You got to go home. And here's your train ticket. By the way, get out of here. Okay. And Oswald is the type of person is if you tell Oswald what not to do, Oswald wants to do it.
Sure.
If you talk to his Marine commanders, look at his lieutenant statements, all you got to do is tell Oswald not to do something. We've all known those kind of people, right? So Oswald decides he's going to stay in the Soviet Union. Thank you very much. Even though they don't want him, and even though they've not used him, he made himself available as a propaganda defector, saying he would speak out against the U.S. But he said that to U.S. media, not to Russian media. The Russians never even did what they did with every other defector who they put in a task and let him make formal. They never did that with Oswald. They want to get rid of this guy. He's obnoxious. So I think Oswald was actually telling the truth when he was on the train. Oswald being very situational, he just got in Russia and things happened. And he didn't end up going to Albert Schweitzer like he planned.
I think it's the perspective you have is one that's one you don't always find in the JFK research world, just because a lot of the people that study the case see Oswald as having some level of involvement. Nobody thinks he's like James Bond, but I think it's also possible that what you're saying, maybe the intelligence agencies were using him as sort of a useful idiot, a tool, etc. but perhaps unwittingly to him, just because of what he was into. I don't know if I'm fully on board, but I will say that, like I was telling you before we started recording, you're one of the most respected authors among the people that I'm friends with in the community and people whose opinions I respect. So, I look forward to reading the new edition of the Oswald Puzzle. Kind of glad I didn't get the first one. I guess I'm being rewarded. Sorry, because I probably would have bought a second one. But anyway, everybody pick that up. Go back, read Larry Hancock's books, and yeah, look, everything's based in the documents. So, if you disagree, you disagree. But I think it's good that you're out there, and you're putting forth evidence-backed conclusions. So appreciate your work, and your work for a long time on this case.
Oh, I appreciate that. And if you're getting it, make sure you get the second edition is the paperback edition. Eventually, the two new chapters will be put onto the Kindle, but not right off. But it's the paperback edition, and yeah, it's a different view. I admit that. But the point is, David and I both feel that there's been too much effort put to force Oswald into various positions. And not let Oswald just be Oswald and say, okay, if Oswald is just Oswald, how does this play? And that's just a different view. I, can't swear to it being true, but it's pretty consistent. I guess that is, if you just let Oswald be Oswald, Oswald's personal agenda, think about this. This is a guy who's a Marine. He's very literate. He's very well read. He's got a solid IQ. He's very combative. De Morenshield said he was a proto hippie. Right. So he's outside the establishment and he decides he wants to get involved. He wants to go to Russia. He wants to go to Cuba. It would be insane not to think that the intelligence agencies would not see an opportunity. And the deniability works best when the people you're using don't know that they're being used. That makes it perfectly deniable. So we should have probably called it perfect deniability or something. But hey, thanks for having me back on. It was a great discussion.
Absolutely. All right. Well, the next thing we have coming up on Solving JFK is Cuba. We're going to be diving into Cuba and Fidel Castro as a potential culprit, as separate from the conversation of Cuban exiles, which I'm going to take a 4-month hiatus after we finish Cuba and then come back to Cuban exiles and the CIA because. Gonna have a little, I'm gonna take a little bit of relaxation, but mostly reading and research. Well, hey, thanks again. And yeah, love to have you on again once I get through the Oswald puzzle. All right.
Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.